Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is AB Dowji and this is the big picture. Right, a little bit of a delay there, some technical problems there. Ahlan wa sahlan, the big picture, where anything can happen and usually does. We unpack the conspiracies, we deliver a sharp kick to the war criminals who pose as world leaders, and then we expose the hypocrisy, the double dealings, and the sheer gangsterism that dominates the cesspool known as international politics. And of course, we also have a few laughs along the way. No good getting too serious about things. Blood pressure can shoot right up and ulcers start popping away. Especially when we see what's being done to Muslims and what Muslims are doing to other Muslims. Enough to give you a terrible migraine. So, on with the show. Right. I've got a couple of light ones at the start as usual. You know what, these days, let me just start by saying that these days, weddings are such expensive affairs. You know, a long time ago, it was very simple. Get a hall, put up the trestle tables, trestle paper, paper cups and plates. Rashid Bhai got the digs going on outside. And everyone had a lekker chow. Her food was fantastic. Usually, just biryani and nothing else. Some soji and that's about it. And some weak juice, of course. Everyone was invited. Everyone was invited. The whole town. No terms and conditions. Today, sure, the decor alone will mean taking out a second loan on the house. The table settings. And you know what? Next to your plate, there is something wrapped in gold paper with some like a netting over it and a label. Ridwan and Amira, thank you for coming. And the catering. Wow. The welcome drink at the entrance is an absolute must. Mint and lemonade with a slice of lemon. The whole affair can get you your bank balance into Sakarat. The caterers charge per head. So, you know what? Let me ask you this question. What's the most difficult part of the whole wedding preparations, eh? What's the most difficult part? Well, let me tell you. It's when you sit at the dining room table with your family and try to work out who to invite and who to leave out. Biggest headache. No. We can't leave Aisha Ben out because she always calls us for all her children's weddings. Yeah, but if you invite her, then what about her daughter-in-law with her three brats? They will run around, running amok. How they pulled down the tablecloth at Mariam's wedding last year. Eh? Aisha Ben can't drive, so the daughter-in-law has to bring her. Don't invite Uncle Fancy Farouk. He will start talking about his piles operation that failed just when everybody starts eating. And his wife likes to just argue and fight with everyone. And so, dear listeners, people are cancelled and people are added. It's a big headache. Big headache. Right. And after the wedding, the big faces from those who were not invited. How they told Sarah to come with their big daughters but left me out just because they got big fancy factory and they like to show off traveling London everywhere. We staying in Phoenix? Wait till I see Auntie Zora. Give her peace of my mind. It's a minefield, dear listeners. Minefield. All this brings me to the story of a first-class mampara. A man from Clackamas in Oregon, in the good old U.S. of A., 38-year-old Sonny Donnie Smith was really fed up that he was not invited to a family wedding. What made him more fed up was that his father and brother were invited. Made him very, very, very cross. So when they were due to fly out to attend the wedding, this Ullu phoned the security officers at McCann International Airport in Las Vegas and the airport in Midland, Texas, and told them that these two persons are terrorists. Well, as you can imagine, when the father and brother tried to check in, they were detained and questioned, and so they missed the flight and missed the wedding. Well, the FBI began an investigation and found out that there was no terrorist threat. And when they investigated further, they found that this Laddu, Sonny Smith, was responsible for the hoax call. Well, he was arrested and now faces a fine of $250,000, and now will get a special invitation to spend 2 years in jail. And speaking about planes, a plane was flying from Oslo to Oslo in Norway to Munich in Germany. 20 minutes after takeoff, it had to turn back because of an emergency. The toilet was not working. And here's the funny part. On board the plane, there were 84 plumbers, all professionals working for a plumbing company called Rockyop. But they could do nothing. Why? Because the problem could only be fixed from outside of the plane. And chief executive of the company, Frank Olsen, said, "We fixed any plumbing job, but sending one of our guys outside at 10,000 feet is a bit risky." He said that with a laugh. Now, here's a very strange one. In order to fight environmental pollution, it's a big thing today. Fighting and environment. We are told to recycle things that we throw away. In South Africa, it's done in a very simple way. Here in Isipingo, there's a very long line of people outside a huge scrap metal place. You know, I really feel sorry for these old women sitting next to the pile of rusty scrap iron, sometimes in the cold or rain or boiling hot weather, waiting for their turn to enter and collect a few rands to survive. Very, very sad indeed. But the big picture is that they are helping to clean the environment. And I'm sure that you see people, you must be seeing people digging in your garbage bags that you put outside your homes for collection, and they dig in there and they take out the plastic bottles and cardboard items to sell them to the recycling plants. And in the cities you find places where you can put your cardboard or plastic bottles or glass bottles in special drums which are specially labeled, so that plastic bottles only go into the drum marked plastic and so on. One lady, Alison Mapletoft from Hove in East Essex in England, is very, very cross. She runs a business from home making designer scarves and cushion covers and so on. She received 8 small cushions by mail, it was in a small cardboard box. And she took out the cushions and she went outside and threw the small cardboard box into one of the big recycling drums that the council had put up. But she made a big mistake. She put the box in the wrong drum. And a security company working for the town council, put a fine in her post box. And what was the amount? £600. That's just over 10,000 rands. Can you believe it? 10,000 rands for putting a cardboard box into the wrong receptacle. Well, she was very angry, as you can understand. But in the end, she paid up and also wrote to the council to say that this was really way over the limit, just for a simple mistake. And she's waiting for a response. Well, remember I told you some time ago about the Toblerone scandal? You don't remember? Well, Mona Sahlin was elected to parliament in Sweden in 1982. She was the youngest person to become an MP. In 1995, Prime Minister Ingvar Carlsson was due to resign and the favorite to take over from him was Mona Sahlin. But a huge scandal erupted. Mona Sahlin had used a government-issued credit card to buy a bar of chocolate. Toblerone, not allowed. The credit card could only be used to pay for things related to government work, and chocolate is not one of them. So, because of this wrongdoing, she had to give up her chance of becoming Prime Minister. Wow! Amazing, isn't it? I wonder if our dear Yaqub Bhai, our dear President Zuma, if he accidentally paid for a Kit Kat with a government credit card, would he feel ashamed and resign? What do you think, eh? But things are becoming very, very difficult, eh? Very difficult. And you know what? Things are beginning to look really bad for him. The noose is tightening. But you know what? I was thinking of something. The opposition parties have been calling on the ANC to root out corruption. They have been saying this very loudly, and for years and years, the ANC did nothing. And so, they caught a heavy clap at the last elections. They lost supporters. But the opposition never gave up, and by putting huge pressure, they got the ANC to act. And so, SABC heads rolled, and Eskom's and many other departments. So, this call by the opposition is like a double-edged sword, meaning you lift the sword to hit your opponent, and then you cut yourself also on the forehead in doing that while hitting the enemy. A double-edged sword. If the opposition kept quiet and let the corruption continue, the ANC would lose more supporters to the DA or EFF. But by pushing so hard against corruption, and therefore heads are rolling, and maybe even the cute head of Yaqub Bhai, the public has now new confidence in the ANC. Those who left, may even return. Cyril is telling the rogues, Ambapozi. Cyril also said at a big meeting that he is happy that the meeting is starting on time for a change. And this is how it's going to be in the future. Discipline, that's the word. No late starts. This is the new South Africa, and we have to stick to time. Well, I wish we could set the same rules, and those who break it should follow the example of what happened in the British Parliament. Now, usually, if you are late for a meeting, you will just, of course, apologize, and that's it. But this was not the case with Lord Michael Bates. He is the International Development Minister in the House of Lords. A very important question was directed at him by Baroness Lister. But Lord Michael Bates was not in the chamber to answer the question. He was just a few minutes late, maybe 3 or 4 minutes. And then he took his place and said this. This is what he said. I want to offer my sincere apologies to Baroness Lister for my discourtesy in not being in my place to answer her question on a very important matter at the beginning of questions. During the 5 years in which it's been my privilege to answer questions from this dispatch box on behalf of the government, I've always believed that we should rise to the highest possible standards of courtesy and respect in responding on behalf of the government to the legitimate questions of the legislature. I am thoroughly ashamed at not being in my place, and therefore I shall be offering my resignation to the Prime Minister with immediate effect. I do apologize. And this is what Bates said as he gathered his belongings and swiftly exited the chamber. Well, whew, can you believe it, eh? He resigned because he was ashamed that he was a few minutes late. Amazing. I wonder if Cyril Motta's call that from now onwards everyone must be at meetings on time will mean that MPs will resign if they came a few minutes late to Parliament. I can't wait for this new South Africa. So exciting, eh? And speaking about exciting, well, let's just go for a break and I'll tell you a little bit more.
The program is called The Big Picture. Shannon Ibrahim is the group foreign editor for the independent newspaper Group. And she writes amazing articles that are published nationally in various papers. And it usually focuses on international politics. And she is usually my weekend special guest. Shannon Ibrahim, welcome to The Big Picture.
Good morning, AB.
Good morning to you, right. And thank you for being my weekend special guest.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm having a little bit of a problem hearing you.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay, so, you know, some people say that Trump has no clearly defined foreign policy, that he just makes it up as he goes along. Have you picked up any new direction that his government is taking?
Well, definitely. About 2 weeks ago now, the National Security Doctrine was announced by the Pentagon. And that really shocked most of us because basically what it says is that the threat to the United States is no longer terrorism, but it's Russia and China, and that will be the new focus of U.S. foreign policy and defense policy. And the U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis, who basically made this announcement, he characterized Russia and China not only as being territorially aggressive, but revisionist states who are out to undermine the international system. So that language is very similar to that of the U.S. National Security Strategy that came out about a month ago, where Russia and China were referred to as nations that seek to create a world consistent with their authoritarian models. So clearly this marks a significant shift in U.S. policy back to big power competition.
So what's behind the focus on these two countries?
Well, the U.S. wants to ratchet up the tensions with Russia and China at a time when Trump had actually softened his approach towards the two global powers when he entered office in January a year ago. And I think there are probably a few possible explanations. One is that the U.S. Defense Department wants to engage in a massive military buildup, and for that they need significant increases in the U.S. military budget. It's difficult for the Defense Department to convince the U.S. Congress at any normal time that they need significant new revenue in the absence of a clear and present danger. So the U.S. also needs to have a reliable market for its arms, and that means it needs to create a regional threat to give it an array of clients to sell arms to.
But there are conflicts all over, especially in the Middle East.
Yes, when one reflects on the new global realities, ISIS has been dealt a crushing blow, as we know, in Syria. It's lost its declared caliphate in Raqqa, and it's largely being defeated in Iraq. As we know, Iraq is now in the process of rebuilding following the devastating conflict with ISIS, and it doesn't really pose an imminent threat. And in Afghanistan, we see somewhat of a stalemate where neither the U.S. occupying forces nor the Taliban have the ability to declare a military victory, and that remains a simmering conflict as it has for much of the past 17 years. So a conventional or a nuclear conflagration with Iran or North Korea, that seems to be more on the back burner now. There are too many risks to the United States and its allies if it were to take any preemptive action against either nation. So in the absence of an identifiable and overwhelming threat that would necessitate major new defense spending in the U.S., they have to raise, or they feel they have to raise, the specter of Russia and China as a grave danger to U.S. national security and interest. I would say here we go again. We've been there, done that. But it's not a new Cold War of the type following World War II, because the political ideologies of capitalism and communism, which divided East and West, they are no longer relevant. but the antagonism of that period is set to raise its ugly head from now on, and that probably presents a far greater danger than ever before.
Right, if you've just joined us, this is The Big Picture, and we are speaking to Shannon Ibrahim, who is the group foreign editor for the Independent Group of Newspapers. Shannon, in the absence of any threat, has the U.S. taken any provocative action?
It did. The day after James Mattis announced this new national security doctrine, it seemed almost as if the U.S. was opening the firing shot in a new race to the bottom. The day after, basically, the U.S. blatantly antagonized China by sending a U.S. warship 12 nautical miles off the Huangyan Island in the South China Sea, which China says is its territory. And China responded by accusing the U.S. of violating its sovereignty. And then following that on a Monday editorial in one of China's state-run newspapers, where you'll often see the official line, there was a clear warning which said, if the relevant party once more makes trouble out of nothing and causes tensions, it will cause China to speed up the building of its abilities in the South China Sea. So we can see China's taking a very hard line, and it's denounced the U.S. government for having a Cold War and a zero-sum mentality. And it's maintaining that it seeks global partnerships rather than global hegemony. It's not a threat to the world, and it's called on the international community to have what it always says is a shared future for mankind, basically as a counter to the U.S.'s warmongering.
So do Russia and China understand why the U.S. is behaving in this manner?
They both seem to recognize the other factor which is driving this new U.S. aggression, and that is really insecurity. The U.S. feels it's lost the control it once exerted over world affairs and in previous decades, and it's faced with a new reality that it no longer is the world's undisputed leader. So this new confrontational approach is now showing a real sign of weakness. So instead of the U.S. engaging in multilateralism to solve world issues, it's actually acting unilaterally in order to keep control. And even Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov alluded to this when he said in his response to this new U.S. doctrine that the U.S. is striving to prove their leadership by pursuing a confrontational approach.
So, Shannon, in conclusion, where is all this leading to?
It makes me think of another Chinese editorial that I read that says once the U.S. departs from cooperation with China, it will find that the cost of maintaining its global interests will get higher and higher. So if anything, we are witnessing the end of an American empire, and as the U.S. prepares to spend more taxpayers' money on its military arsenal, it will only weaken its own country at a time when China is focusing on people-centered development and really strengthening itself from within. When one considers that the U.S. already spends $600 billion on defense annually, and you compare that to Russia's $47 billion annually, I think that says it all in terms of where we're going.
Okay, let's just shift gears a little bit. And your latest article is entitled South Africa's BRICS Summit Opportunity. Can you tell us what that is all about?
Well, basically, South Africa is hosting the next BRICS Summit on July 25th to 27th. And last week, there were a number of workshops with civil society and different government departments to see how we can prepare effectively and coordinate ahead of this BRICS Summit, because it's a very big opportunity for South Africa to leverage. And this coming week will be the BRICS Sherpa meeting, almost the whole week. And the Sherpa means the diplomat who's the point person in charge of preparing for BRICS. In our case, it's the Deputy Director General at DERCO, Anil Suklo. And so his counterparts from the other BRICS meetings will be in Cape Town discussing how to prepare. But really, this is an amazing opportunity for South Africa to leverage the support of these big economies, Russia, China, India, Brazil, behind the African agenda and South Africans' agenda. And we saw last year at the Xiamen Summit in China, each country that hosts the BRICS Summit, they decide basically on the agenda. They want to create a BRICS Plus, which means a number of other emerging economies other than just those five. And so I feel that if that does end up happening, South Africa's privileged position as the only African country that's formally into the BRICS, that might be diluted in the future. So we should really use this opportunity to leverage whatever we can in terms of what we want to accomplish as South Africa.
Right. Are you there, Shannon?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, there you are, folks. Wonderful analysis from Sharon Ibrahim, the group editor, the foreign editor for the international, for the independent newspaper group. And she's my weekend special guest. Shannon, thank you very much for being on The Big Picture.
Thanks very much, AJ. Have a good weekend.
And you
Bye-bye.
Too. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Right. Let's move on with the show. And let me see where I left off before the ad break. Let me see if I can find my place there. And yes, I was telling you about the exciting new South Africa that we will be embarking on with our new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who wants to instill some discipline into the way things work. Well, and speaking about exciting, the new Saudi Arabia is on track for exciting new ventures. The custodians are working very fast to transform, or should I say, reform the country. Listen to this. The decision by the Saudi government in December to allow cinemas opens up significant opportunities for Western entertainment companies, and the jostling for pole position is well underway. There's a race on. Big corporations such as UK-based VUE, the Canadian company IMAX, and the American giant AMC are all exploring commercial deals in a sector that is seen as a key driver in rebranding the global image of the kingdom. The Saudi authorities believe that over the next decade, cinemas will generate $24 billion in revenues and create 30,000 new jobs with the opening of 300 theaters by 2030. Vision 2030, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's strategy to revolutionize the Saudi economy and free it from oil dependency, has set a target of nearly tripling household spending to 6% on culture and entertainment, and a significant part of that is centered on cinemas. Mohammed bin Salman isn't limiting his entertainment vision to cinema. As Vision 2030 puts it, we are well aware that the cultural and entertainment opportunities currently available do not reflect the rising aspirations of our citizens and residents, nor are they in harmony with our prosperous economy. Music and food festivals, fashion shows, live theater, and sports are all seen as effective ways to connect with the young Saudis who constitute his support base as he drives through fundamental economic and social change in the kingdom. It also is a way of saying to the world that Saudi Arabia, the so-called secret kingdom and the land of puritanical strand of Islam, is open to change and open to the entertainment business while it moves rapidly towards what MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, calls moderate Islam. So there you are, folks. Salman Bhai is going full steam ahead. Full steam. He has already put aside $200 billion for the huge project known as Vision 2030. Well, he seems to have reached half of his target. He got half of his target. It's reported that those multi-millionaire businessmen, that he locked up at the fancy Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh, gave up $100 billion to be set free, transforming Saudi Arabia to a new 30-valve twin-cam bi-turbo machine is a very expensive business. And let's not forget the lovely tanks and planes donated by Donald Trump in exchange for a couple of $100 billion. All very exciting stuff indeed. Yes, not a week can go by without a mention of my dear friend President Pagla. This goofy really makes me laugh. He's just a big harmless buffoon. Reminds me, as I told you before, of a dog chasing a car, barking madly, looking fierce. Then when the car stops at the robots, the dog doesn't know what to do. Quite silly. It looks very silly as he just stands there not knowing what to do. That's Donald Trump. I nearly say Ronald Reagan. That's Donald Trump. Shouted during the election campaign, waved his arms around, said he was going to put Hillary Clinton in jail, and made a lot of noise. Then when he won the race and went into the White House, well, being president, he realized, is a very big job. Very big job. You need to be highly intelligent, have a very sharp brain, and, shame, eh? Where there is supposed to be a brain is an empty space for my dear friend Donald. Like one of those round donuts with a hole in the middle. Actually, that's it. That is a good example. So maybe we should call him Donut Trump. Donut Trump. He may be president, but he definitely hasn't got the intelligence to act and make decisions like a president. If he's not ready if he's not reading from a screen in front of him, which is called a teleprompter, and on the teleprompter is a speech written for him by a group of professional speech writers employed by the White House. If he's just speaking off the cuff, then he sounds like a real moron. Well, he drinks 10 cans of Pepsi a day, and he watches TV, and he plays a lot of golf at every opportunity. Just sneaks out of the White House to play golf. Right? I just read this morning. Trump's former golfing partner is 15 times LPGA Tour champion Susan Peterson. This is from the British Independent newspaper. Everyone knows Donald Trump loves to play golf. Every moment he can, he gets out of the White House to make the rounds at one of his private courses. But now it has been claimed the president cheats like hell on the golf course, an allegation apparently leveled at Trump by no other than a former golfing partner and 15-time LPGA Tour winner Susan Peterson. The Norwegian player told the Verdensgang newspaper, "He cheats like hell, so I don't quite know how he is in business. They say that if you cheat at golf, you cheat at business. I'm pretty sure he pays his caddy very well, since no matter how far into the woods he hits the ball, it's in the middle of the fairway when we get there." What do you think of that, eh? Big cheater, eh? Big cheating clown, that's what he is. So here's a question. If Donut Trump is playing golf, watching TV and guzzling Pepsis, who is running the country? Who is making the big decisions? And the answer, dear friends, is given by Chris Hedges. He's a top political commentator. Here's a brief CV. He has spent 2 decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America and the Middle East, Africa and the Balkans. He has reported from more than 50 countries and has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, the National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News and the New York Times, for which he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years. Let me read you an extract from his article. It's entitled The Useful Idiocy of Donald Trump. The Useful Idiocy of Donald Trump. I like the title. It implies that because Trump is a moron, people around him are happy to make the decisions for him, for their own benefit. He leaves it to them and they make the best of it. Here are some extracts I'm going to read very, very slowly. Coming almost to the end of the program, so let me just rush through it, not read it slowly. The problem with Donald Trump is not that he is imbecilic and inept. It is that he has surrendered total power to the oligarchic and military elites. They get what they want. They do what they want. Although the president is a one-man wrecking crew aimed at democratic norms and institutions, although he has turned the United States into a laughingstock around the globe, our national crisis is embodied not in Trump, but the corporate state's now unfettered pillage. That means the corporate, the big companies are busy stealing the money. Pillage. Trump, who has no inclination or ability to govern, has handed the machinery of government over to the bankers, corporate executives, right-wing think tanks, intelligence chiefs and generals. They are eradicating the few regulations and laws that inhibited a naked kleptocracy. They are dynamiting the institutions, including the State Department, that served interests other than corporate profit, and are stacking the courts with right-wing corporate-controlled ideologues. Trump provides the daily entertainment. The elites handle the business of looting, exploiting, and destroying. Well, there's a lot more to go through, but I think for the moment I'll just leave it there and go to some light at the end of the tunnel for this part of the program. You know, some guys will use any excuse to start a conversation with a female. And usually the ladies are pretty sharp and will stop them in their tracks with a lack of verbal clap. A fellow was sitting next to a pretty lady in the plane. He turns to her and says, nice perfume. Which one is it? I want to give it to my wife. And the lady turns to him and gives him a look and says, don't give her. Some idiot will find an excuse to talk to her. Right, let's see if we got one more. You know, it's been 1.5 years since I went to the U.S. Consulate here in Durban to apply for a visa. And I paid $2,700 or something like that at one counter. And then moved to the next counter where there was a very pleasant fellow, an American. And he says, so where are you going to? And I said, well, I got a Caribbean cruise. I'm taking a whole group down there. And he said, wow, that's amazing. I said, yes. And then he said, where else are you going? I said, from Miami, I'm going down to the Bahamas and so on. And he said, wonderful stuff. And then, he took my passport and then asked and told me how wonderful it is down there in Miami and so on. And then he turned and looked at his screen and then his face just changed completely. And then he gave my passport back to me and a piece of paper which said, administrative process. So I said, what's this about? And he said, no, well, we're going to still do some administrative processing. Sure, 1.5 years for administrative processing. I wonder what they're processing. Anyway, Ronnie from Mirbank, he also went to the consulate. And this is what happened. The officer, they asked him, where are you going to in the United States? And Ronnie said, to San Jose. And the man said, sir, it's pronounced San Jose. San Jose. J is pronounced as H in the United States. So Ronnie said, oh, okay. Then the officer said, so how long do you plan to be in the United States? And Ronnie said, From January to Hoon, or maybe Hulai. This is David Aujibidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.